Matt, most people trying to explain poverty focus on welfare or bad schools or incarceration rates. You look at housing, especially the private rental market. Why did you decide to focus on housing?
You know, America is unmatched for any developed democracy for the depth and expanse of its poverty. And that's always troubled me and disturbed me. And I always thought that was unnecessary. And so I wanted to try to dig into that and kind of figure out what are some of the main drivers of poverty today. And you're right. You know, we have a lot of books about jobs and joblessness in the inner city, welfare reform, mass incarceration. But housing, especially the private rental market where most poor families live.
So they don't usually live in public housing.
That's exactly right. You know, I think that most Americans, when they think of the typical low-income family, they think they live in public housing or receive some sort of government assistance. But the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 households that qualify for any kind of housing assistance receive it, which is unsettling and astonishing. And just imagine if we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for food stamps. But that's exactly how we treat housing today in this country. And in some of our largest cities, the waiting list for public housing isn't counted in years, it's counted in decades. So you could be a young dad or a young mom and apply for public housing in our nation's capital and be a grandfather or grandmother by the time your application came up.
So this is kind of a new way of looking at poverty then? I mean, focusing on housing?
Yes. I think that when you look into the private rental market, you see it as a main driver of poverty today in our country. It consumes so much of the incomes of low-income families. It dictates where they live, who they live with. It drives residential instability. And so I think that, you know, after studying this problem for years, I've come to the conclusion that we can't fix poverty without fixing housing.
What surprised you most as you were doing the research for this project?
A big surprise to me was just how frequent evictions were. You know, when you read about eviction scenes in the 1930s and 1940s, they're weird. You know, they're scandalous. They're rare. You know, they draw crowds. People confront the marshals. They sit on furniture. They move people back in. They refuse to accept this scene of forcing a family out of their home. But today, you know, evictions have become, frankly, commonplace.
How common are they?
So in the city of Milwaukee, which is the city I've studied most, every day in the city of Milwaukee, about 40 people are evicted from their homes. They're evicted in the summer. They're evicted in the winter. They're evicted all year round. It's an astonishing number, but that only counts formal court-ordered evictions that we can see by looking at legal records. But there are other ways to move a family out. So I've met landlords that will pay a family to move. I've met landlords that will take your door off. And so we designed a survey to look at and capture these what we call informal evictions. And we interviewed over 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee. And if you look at informal evictions that don't go through the court, formal evictions that do, if you count landlord foreclosures, you know, when the landlord loses his property or her property to the bank, and also building condemnations, you know, when the city shuts down the property because it's unfit for human habitation. You look at all those, you learn that about 1 in 8 renters in the city of Milwaukee are evicted every 2 years. That's an astonishing number.
1 in 8?
It's an astonishing number, yeah.
Wow. Is this mainly hitting African Americans?
It is. I mean, if you spend any time in eviction court, you'll see that eviction affects the young and the old. It affects the able-bodied and the sick. It affects white folks, African American folks, immigrant communities. But it's absolutely having a disproportionate effect on low-income African American communities. And especially within those communities, women and moms with kids. You know, the face of America's eviction epidemic is mothers with children. Most households evicted in Milwaukee have children living with them. We asked renters, have you ever been evicted in your life? About 1 in 5 Black women in Milwaukee who are renters say that yes, 1 in 5. The comparison is 1 in 15 for white women renters. And so I've come to think of eviction as kind of the feminine equivalent of incarceration. You know, if we see in low-income African-American communities so many men being swept up by the criminal justice system and locked up, we're seeing so many women in those communities locked out, you know, affected by eviction, and they're bearing the costs and ramifications of it. But this is also a problem that's spreading and growing. You know, today, national statistics show that about 1 in 5 of all renters are paying at least 50% of their income on housing. So this is a problem that's affecting a lot of communities.
I mean, what you're saying basically is they don't have money to do the rest of their lives. I mean, for food and clothing and all of that stuff. I mean, so much money is going into just paying the rent.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if you look in the last 10 years, you see that incomes, especially for low-income Americans, have been stagnant. Sometimes they've even fallen in real terms. But housing costs have soared. They've soared all around the country in terms of rent and in terms of utility costs. And we've reached a point in America today where most low-income families are paying at least 50% of their income on housing costs, and 1 in 4 are paying over 70% of their income just on rent and to keep the lights on.
70%?
70%. And, you know, we as a country long ago decided that 30% of your income is what people should spend on housing. 30% gives you enough to money left over for food and transportation, to invest in your children, to buy some clothes now and again. But when you're giving so much of your income on housing, eviction becomes much more of an inevitability than the result of some irresponsibility.
Now, to do this study, you lived in Milwaukee for a while. You lived in a rooming house in a black neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side, and then you also lived in a white trailer park on the south side. Did you see a lot of differences? I mean, were there racial discrepancies there?
You know, it matters. And, we've been talking about statistics, but I started this in the old-fashioned way of moving into communities and embedding myself with families getting evicted and landlords doing the evicting. I knew that to really understand this problem, I also had to get landlords' perspective, too. What I saw was the difference between white individuals getting evicted and black individuals getting evicted had to do with the time spent trying to find new housing. You know, so I'm thinking of a woman I met named Arlene, and she was a single mom. She had 2 boys. When we met, she was spending 88% of her income just on rent, to rent a 2-bedroom, pretty shabby apartment.
So she had no money left for anything else.
No money left for anything else. And after one eviction, she moved to a shelter and she started looking for housing. And she looked at 20 and then 40 and then 60 and then 80 places. You know, I counted, you know, and a lot of folks had said no.
Wait, so she went and looked at these places and they wouldn't rent to her?
They wouldn't rent to her. And one of the reasons, besides her poverty, also had to do with her children. So some landlords just said, you know, we don't want your kids, ma'am. We know from audit studies that discrimination against people with children, called family discrimination, is still common and rampant. And that certainly was the case in Arlene's life. She just didn't have time to think about that. You know, she just dialed another number. There's something else that prevented her from finding more housing, which is her eviction record. So evictions that go through the court come with a record, just like a criminal record does. And they follow you around and they have consequences on your life, just like a criminal record does. And so many landlords just refuse to rent to anyone with a recent eviction record. And that's why we know and we see this not only on the ground level in families' lives, but also in statistics, that evicted families move from poor neighborhoods to even worse neighborhoods. They move from not great housing to even more shoddier housing. And the reason for that is because they're kind of being pushed into the bottom of the market because of their eviction record.
And how does race figure into this?
So back to Arlene's story, I never saw white families spend so much time looking for housing. And one of the reasons was, you know, racial discrimination in the housing market is still real. And I can tell you, you know, list off, you know, study after study that reaffirms this. But maybe I should just tell you a story. Mm-hmm. And so I was spending time with 2 young African-American women, Crystal and Vanetta. And they had been evicted, both of them. They met at a homeless shelter and decided to kind of throw their lot in together, pull their money to pay rent. And they went to look for apartments on the near south side of the city of Milwaukee, which is predominantly Latino. And they went into one apartment, and I stayed back in the car. I was watching. It was my turn to watch Vanetta's kids. And they went in to hear the women tell it. They were looking around. The apartment was small, pretty shoddy, and didn't have a bath. Vanetta had 3 young kids, and anyone who has 3 young kids knows you got to have the bath. And so she asked the landlord, you know, do you have another place? Is it, you know, anything with a bath? And the landlord kind of reflexively said, yes, I have a bigger place close. It's the same rent. It has a has a bath, a bit nicer, and then he suddenly stopped himself and pretended to answer his phone, had a fake conversation, and then hung up and said, you know, wouldn't you know it, you know, just rented it. And the women came back out. Vanetta was just shaking with shame, you know, embarrassment. And so I took down that landlord's number. I'm a white guy. And I called him up the next day, and I went and toured that place. And then I said, you know, and I told him that I made the same income as Crystal and Vanetta had. I told him that I had three kids, just like Vanetta did. And I said, you know, you have anything with a bath? And they said, absolutely. And he drove me to the place and showed it to me. And, you know, that's one story, but that's a story that's repeated over and over in the lives of people like Vanetta and Crystal. And I think that still matters, even at the very bottom of the market.
Hmm. Now, you also got to know landlords.
Yep.
As well as the renters who kept getting evicted. Tell me about that. I mean, did you get to know landlords well?
Very well. You know, I decided that if you were getting evicted, I needed to get just as close with your landlord as with you. I needed to understand why they evict you and not me. You know, why they buy property in some of the worst neighborhoods in the city. What motivates them? What ticks them off? I try to kind of capture landlords' perspectives. I think we let ourselves off the hook if we say, you know, the problem, it's just irresponsible tenants. Or, you know, the problem, it's just greedy landlords. You know, it's a lot more complicated than that. And my book really tries to plumb that complication.
Well, let me ask you about one landlord you write about, Sharina.
Right.
Is that her name? So my reading of the book, I mean, she basically is a slum landlord. I mean, she keeps a lot of houses in, they're often in terrible shape. I mean, sometimes not a functioning toilet or refrigerator even, you know, roaches all over the place. Does she justify how she keeps these houses in such bad shape?
So I never call Sharina a slum landlord. I feel that my job is to document things as closely and accurately as possible, and you can use the label that you see fit. Sharina would say that she was offering low-income tenants who didn't have a lot of options housing. And for that deal, she cut some corners. She cut some corners. Now, there are laws that prevent that. There are laws that try to make sure that people have access to decent and safe housing and give them rights, you know, like calling a building inspector, you know, fining a landlord for housing violations. But I think it's important to recognize that those rights, kind of in a literal way, cost money. Let me just explain what I mean. So the Hinkston family is a family I write about in the book, and Shereen is their landlord. And they were a family that were jammed into this little tiny two-bedroom apartment, eight people living in there. It was tough. And there are folks living there that shouldn't have been. You know, Doreen Hinkston, the mother of the house, took in her daughter after she was evicted. And that house slowly started to wear and tear. The plumbing got stopped up over and over again. Doors came off the hinges. Windows were broken. It was in a bad shape. And Doreen and her oldest daughter, Patrice, talked about calling the building inspector, reporting Sharina. But they knew that Sharina would probably evict them if they made that call. Retaliatory evictions like that are illegal, but you can evict someone at any time for violating the terms of the lease, like if you're behind in rent or if you have unauthorized boarders, like the Hinkstons did. And so those laws and those protections, they don't reach to the very bottom. They don't extend to people like Arlene, who someday will have to ask her landlord's compassion, and they don't extend to people like the Hinkstons that are trying to make ends meet by doubling up.
So you're saying that there are these kind of informal arrangements between landlord and renter. So it's not necessarily paying the sticker price, but in return, you don't get a fully functioning house.
You can trade the health of your kids, your human dignity, your tolerance for living with lead and exposed wires and no heat. You can trade that for a roof over your head. And the sad situation is that a lot of low-income families are facing exactly that predicament.
What was it like for you to see this? I mean, to see these people who were often just thrown out on the street and, you know, with all their possessions.
Right. I was with Arlene once during an eviction, and it was freezing. It was one of the coldest days Milwaukee has experienced in over a decade. It was the weathermen were working themselves up, you know, saying people should stay inside. Milwaukee public schools closed. It's got to be cold to close Milwaukee public schools. And but if Arlene waited any longer, you know, men with badges and guns would show up with a team of movers and would physically extract her and her children from the house. And I went along with the sheriffs and the moving squad a lot. I've seen dozens and dozens of evictions. I've seen an eviction where we went into the house and it was just kids. It was just kids. The mom had died. And the kids had just gone on living, and it was raining. The sheriffs moved the kids out, moved their stuff out, closed the door, moved on to the next eviction. That had a big effect on me. You know, it left me heartbroken. It left me depressed. I mean, this cold denial of basic needs had a deep personal effect on me. But, and you know, this is a big but for me. I saw a lot of brilliance and a lot of spunk and a lot of spirit in the face of adversity. I heard laughter, you know, I heard jokes. And I think that the book chronicles these moments. I remember this time I was spending time with Bennett and Crystal, the women that I mentioned with the discrimination story. They were homeless, and they were eating lunch at McDonald's. And this boy walks in. He was maybe 9 or 10, and his clothes were disheveled. Looked like someone had maybe hit him in the side of the face. And he didn't go around. He didn't go, you know, up to the counter to order. He was just, he went around to the tables. He was looking for scraps. And Crystal and Vanetta noticed him at the same time. And, you know, Crystal said, what you got? You know, and these women, these homeless women, dug into their pockets, pulled the little money that they had, went up to that boy and bought him lunch. And Crystal gave him this big hug and sent him on his way. And she just, you know, watched him go and said, you know, I wish I had me a house. I'd take him in. And those moments just reminded me how gracefully people refuse to be reduced to their hardships and how poverty is just reducing people born for better things.
Where do people go once they're evicted? I mean, they have no money, basically. As you've said, it's often very hard to get a new place to rent. What resources can they fall back on?
Not a lot. And so some folks go to homeless shelters. Those fill up pretty quickly. So some folks just lie about being domestic violence survivors so they can try to get a warm bed at a domestic violence shelter. Crystal sometimes slept in the lobbies of hotels or on buses or in the Amtrak station. People rely on family and friends, but you kind of burn those bridges sometimes. And sometimes you can't fall back on those ties. And so people often rely on strangers. You know, they meet people at bus stops. They meet people in job centers, even in eviction court, and try to pool their resources and become fast friends. It's something that I call forming disposable ties. That's become a survival strategy that I saw a lot living in these communities. Then we asked people that exact question in eviction court. We interviewed about 200 folks right after their eviction hearing. We said, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? Most folks that just received an eviction judgment, they don't know. They don't know where they're going to go.
They have to find something fast.
Anything. And I think that's really important. You know, a lot of times when we think about, why do people live there? You know, why are cities so segregated? Why do people live in poor neighborhoods?
Yeah, why don't they move to a better neighborhood?
Why don't they move to a better neighborhood? You know, and if you follow someone like Arlene or Vanetta or Crystal after their evictions, you see that, as Arlene liked to tell her or used to tell her 14-year-old son, a house is a house. You know, we take whatever we can get. And that's what, you know, housing and neighborhood selection looks like for those folks, just taking whatever you can get.
So coming back to the landlords and Sharina, the person we were talking about earlier, is this lucrative to rent this poor housing?
Sharina would say, absolutely. And Sharina would say, that's the whole reason I got into it. You know, when I met Sharina, she had only been a landlord for about 4 years. She was a public school teacher before that. But she always thought of herself as an entrepreneur, businesswoman. And she got into landlording to make a profit. When I started this book, I wondered, you know, why would someone own and operate property in some of the worst neighborhoods in the city? And when I finished this project, I wondered why you wouldn't. You know, Sharina made about $10,000 a month after expenses, which is more than a lot of her tenants made an entire year. You know, she bought a condo in Florida. They vacation in the Caribbean every year.
It wasn't her comment, the hood is good?
Yes. The first time we met, she told me, Matt, the hood is good. There's a lot of money to be made there. In the trailer park I lived in, I calculated that landlord's profit margins by his own rent record. So I paid attention to things like vacancies and missed payments. He had a lot of missed payments. About a third of the trailer park were behind at any given month. Calculated property tax records, mortgage records, you name it. I wanted to throw it into the equation. I wanted to try to make it as rigorous and as conservative as possible. And what I found out was, you know, the owner of the trailer park, probably the worst trailer park in the fourth poorest city in Milwaukee, or fourth poorest city in the country, excuse me. Should I just do that again? Mm-hmm. So the landlord of the trailer park of the fourth poorest city in America was making over $400,000 a year after expenses. That's 35 times more than his tenants working full-time minimum wage. So I do think that owning property in the inner city and in poor neighborhoods like trailer parks can be quite lucrative, yes.
So what kind of personal interactions did you have with the landlords? I mean, were you angry at them or did you like them?
I felt that my job was try to understand, you know, and not apologize for behavior, tenants' behavior or landlords' behavior, but try to understand it and try to capture their perspectives. The tenants in the trailer park, some of them called their landlord, his name is Tobin in the book, some of them called Tobin greedy, you know, scumbag. You know, some of them called Tobin good man, honest man, you know, helped me pay for my funeral, bailed me out of jail. When my daughter got sick, he let me slide on the rent, you know, and a lot of the tenants were focused on much smaller, more tangible problems. You know, can you fix my bathtub from sinking to the floor? Those kind of things. And that was their position on the landlords. Yeah.
Was it weird or was it hard for you given your own status? I mean, you know, white, relatively affluent, PhD student doing this research. I mean, now you teach at Harvard. I mean, clearly on the success track, studying people who were totally different than you. I mean, was it hard to connect? Did you have to win their trust, of the people you were talking to?
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to that question, you know, and I think that, you know, when I was on the ground and trying to get close to folks, you know, experiencing really hard things, you know, some folks opened up immediately, you know, some folks just kind of were honest and open to the idea of me trying to capture their story. And others were harder, you know, and others took a lot more work to get into. And there were suspicions in a lot of places. Some folks believed that I was a undercover police officer. I worked for Child Protective Services. I was a spy for the city. I was a drug addict. You name it. I mean, people raised suspicions. And I took those very seriously. I mean, what I was doing was the weird thing, you know, and their suspicions were totally valid. And I think, you know, living in the communities helped a lot. Just spending as much time as I could helped a lot and tried to turn me into something like a perpetual stranger, you know. And I think that status, you can still learn a lot from that.
Well, you at one point in your book, you quote from your journal where you wrote, "I feel dirty collecting these stories and hardships like so many trophies."
Yeah, that's right. And I was trying to be honest about what I was dealing with emotionally. I felt guilty. I felt shameful.
Because you had privilege and they didn't?
I think that's absolutely right. And because I saw in them so much intelligence and so much strength and so much heart and that's been blunted by the circumstances they are facing. And when I left, I think I experienced something like survivor's guilt. So I felt that. But I also have to admit that I felt inspired by them in a way. They taught me so much. And as someone who cares deeply about poverty, you know, having this honor of being invited into people's lives and trying to write about their lives in their full complexity was something that mattered very deeply to me, too.
Well, I get the sense you're kind of doing two things here with this study and this wonderful book that you've written. I mean, one is, you know, you're being the true scholar. You know, you're trying to avoid a lot of sort of overly subjective comments about, you know, this kind of sociological study that you've done. But there's moral outrage underneath here. I mean, you're angry about this poverty, right?
I saw mothers have to choose between paying the rent or buying food for their kids. I saw people living in degrading, terrible conditions. I saw families evicted in weather conditions that were brutal. All this suffering and poverty is shameful and unnecessary. Because it's unnecessary, there's hope. But I do think that, you know, this level of inequality, this depth of poverty, this doesn't align with any American value. This can't be justified by any piece of scripture or holy teaching. There's nothing that we can latch onto, I believe, no moral code that can justify what we've allowed our nation to become.
Do you think it's a basic American right for everyone to have decent housing, affordable housing?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the reason is simple. Without basic shelter, everything else falls apart. You know, this country affords us these beautiful freedoms, you know, these freedoms to better ourselves, better our children, invest in our communities. Without a home, we are just unable to take advantage of those freedoms and opportunities this country offers. And I think that we as a nation have affirmed basic rights of education, provision in old age, access to basic nutrition. And I think that we've done that because we've recognized those things are central to human flourishing. And it's really hard to argue that housing is not central to human flourishing and economic opportunity.
Okay, so if you put on your public policy hat here, what can we do about this?
So the good news is there's a lot that's already been done. And I know that, you know, when we talk about poverty, it can be tough and it can feel like these problems are sticky and eternal. But look at housing. We've made massive strides in the right direction. You know, just a few generations ago, our cities were teeming with slums. You know, children were dying of tuberculosis. You know, there were outhouses in the middle of Philadelphia. We took a battle with slums. And we won. We won that battle. And I'm not naive about the problems that we still face with housing. I've lived in those problems. Most of the time I lived in the trailer park, I didn't have hot water. You know, I get it. But it's undeniable that we've made giant leaps forward in terms of housing quality. And it's also really encouraging to me that we have organizations all around the country working really hard at decreasing family homelessness, preventing eviction. So one thing I've done is started an organization called Just Shelter. And if you're in St. Louis or San Francisco or Milwaukee, you can go to the website, justshelter.org. You can click on a map and you can see organizations in your own community working hard on these very issues. Now, big picture. If we believe that housing is a right, if we believe that access to stable, affordable shelter is part of what it means to be an American, how do we deliver on that obligation? And I think the best way to deliver on a scale that does justice to the scale of the problem is to take a program we already have, housing voucher program, and expand that, make that a universal program.
What would that do?
It would be, so the idea is very simple. So anyone below a certain income level would have access to a housing voucher. They could take that voucher and they could live anywhere they wanted as long as their housing wasn't too expensive or too shabby. And instead of paying 88% of your income to rent, like Arlene did, 70% of your income, 60%, you would pay 30% of your income to rent, and the voucher would cover the rest. What would it do? It would massively change the face of homelessness in America. It would drive family homelessness down. Evictions might become rare again. Poverty would decrease. It would give people the chance to plant roots in their community, allow children to finish school in their schools, give people the opportunity to save a little bit, take a little bit of community college classes. You know what it would do? It would allow moms and dads to feed their kids. You know, we know from studies that after years on the waiting list, when people finally, you know, get a housing voucher, they usually take it to one place. Their freed up income, they take it to one place. It's a grocery store. They buy more food. Their kids become less anemic. They become stronger. But Arlene's kids, Vanetta's kids, the kids of most poor renting families in this country, they're not getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. And I think a universal housing program would make a massive dent in that.
Do you have any idea how much that would cost, this kind of voucher program?
So there's a few things. So there's some economists that suggest we could actually do this without increasing spending that much just by making the program more efficient, you know, by being smarter about how much it should cost, about housing code, and about setting rent ceilings on housing vouchers. But even if we did nothing, there's some estimates that suggest that making a universal housing program would cost an additional $22 billion every year. That would expand total spending on housing programs for low-income families to about $60 billion. That's not a small number, but it's well within our capacity. And I think it's important to recognize when we think about that number that we absolutely have to be smart about how we spend public efforts. But we should also recognize that we already have a universal housing program in this country. It's for homeowners. And most of that benefit goes to folks that that have six-figure incomes. And, you know,
you're talking about the tax breaks you get for owning a home.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, the year Arlene got evicted, we spent about $40 billion a year on direct assistance to the needy for housing programs. That same year, we spent $171 billion on tax breaks for homeowners. And I think that, you know, we should just be honest about that. You know, that should just be something that we consider when we think about spending. You know, one of the richest countries in the world can afford to do more. And if poverty persists in this country, it's not for lack of resources. We lack something else.
One last question. There's an irony in this project that I have to ask about. According to news reports, you got paid a lot of money to write this book. You are a rising star in sociology, professor at Harvard, and the people you study are desperately poor. Does that disparity get to you at some level?
Absolutely, it does. So one thing that we're doing is we're taking the book proceeds, and we're not only starting Just Shelter, and trying to elevate this program on a national level, but we've also started something called the Evicted Book Foundation, and that's to take some of those proceeds and benefit the families in the book directly. There's a board. Families apply to that board for grants, and we deliver grants to those families in ways that stabilize their housing, improve their job security, help invest in their kids. So this is something that I've thought a lot about, and it's something that It's something that I thought a lot about, and we're absolutely using proceeds from the book to help families that are in it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.